Bookers, come on down. You have stumbled upon our midweek author interviews, where we dive into the weird and creative minds of the writing community. At the controls are indie authors Zintra Sullivan, Kay Banning Kellum, and David Atherton Cooper. They still don't know what they're doing, but it's a gold star for effort. Welcome to What the Book Podcast, where scripts and pants are optional.
Hello, bookers. Welcome to our midweek author interview. This is one of my favorite times. I tell you that every week because I do. I love it. I get to sit here. At the moment, it's very early on a Saturday morning and it's freaking cold. So I'm sitting here huddled under a blanket, but still sitting here, and I get to talk to some of my favorite people in the writing community and bring them to you, get you to know their voices, their books, their stories. It's a pleasure, and I am humbled every week by being allowed to do this. Of course, this week we have David, my wonderful co-host, David Atherton Cooper. Hi, David.
Good morning. How are you doing?
I am good. Are you cold down there?
I meant geographically
then. Just put it out there. Meant it
geographically. I'm not cold down there. There is a puddle of duvet sprawled over my lounge with me inside it, shivering quietly. Yes.
See, we're very similar. I love it. I just thought, I better put geographically on that. It's early, people. It's early, and I've only had two coffees. And trust me, I think only the first half's kicked in.
But it's only early over here because elsewhere in the world, it's getting to quitting time and beer time.
It is, and that brings us to our beautiful guest author this week. I've known this guy for a long time. We talk almost daily. Share a lot of shit about each other, so I adore him. I adore him. And of course, it's quitting time over where he lives. I do believe around 5 p.m. So let's.
And he has a name.
Yes, I will. It is Scott Roche. Did I get that last name right, Scott?
You did, and it's funny how we've known each other for so long, but you do have to be careful about pronunciations because we don't. We've never actually talked. It's always been through Twitter direct messages.
It has. And that's why I was sitting there going, gosh, okay, if I looked at your last name, it's Roche. So I really was praying that I was right. And I was. Look at me. Maybe the second coffee is kicking in. I don't know. Welcome
you did
to
better,
the...
You did better than about half the people do on their first try.
Well, look, trust me, with my first name, it's more like 99% of the people on their first try fuck it up. So it's okay. welcome to What the Book Podcast. We are humbled and honored to have you here. I am excited to finally hear your voice and talk to you.
Absolutely. I've been looking forward to this for quite some time.
Yeah. So let's just kick straight off. You write fantasy, yes?
Yes, among other things. One of my writing, I don't know, gods is probably not too strong of a word, has always been Stephen King. And so you can't really nail him or me down to one genre, but the genre I'm probably most well known to would be either fantasy or science fiction. That's most of my more recent stuff is where it falls.
Oh, Stephen King's one of Caleb's gods of writing too, isn't it, David?
Oh, absolutely. We all admire a bit of Mr. King, but Caleb does seem to have a strong passion there. And what a great guy to follow. The man's incredibly versatile.
Oh, and I know if I ever want to tick Caleb off, I just have to bring up King and something that he doesn't agree with. And it's on. I love it. No, but I do like Mr. King. He writes sublime. Honestly, he is a king amongst kings. So if we're talking fantasy and sci-fi, who would be of your writing, who would be your favorite character that you have? Do you have favorites? Do you play favorites with your characters?
Well, it really kind of depends on my mood. I have a couple of favorites because I have a couple of series, and then I have some favorites from some short stories that I've written. I really like the short form. That's my preference, but the money is in longer form. So I write novels because that's what's going to make me more money, and it supports my writing short stories. So I would say probably my two favorite characters are Esho St. Clair, who is my detective in my Gaslamp fantasy series. And I guess my other favorite would be Jenny Dare, who's the protagonist in my young adult science fiction series.
Cool. And is there anything particular, or is it just that you like writing their stories?
Well, I guess they both, we all write ourselves into our stories to some degree or another. And I think Jenny is a lot like I was when I was a teenager, very inquisitive, a single domineering parental figure, super interested in technology and mysteries. And with Esho, it's more of a, have you ever lusted after one of your characters?
Oh, yeah.
With Esho,
oh, yeah.
imagine if Sherlock Holmes was played by the actor that played the captain in Deep Space Nine. That's
nice.
Yeah, he's very suave and very handsome, and but he has a good sense of humor and a deep abiding sense of honor. So yeah, he's not really much of me, but he's definitely a fictional crush. If you can have a crush on something you created, I'm not sure how weird that is.
No, well, it might be weird, but then we're all weird with that one. Mm. Yeah, I've got, and strangely, it's not my main protagonists that I end up having a crush about. I've got a few side characters whose stories just sort of weave around the edges of what's going on. And there's a couple of those that are just, one day I would love to meet them if they could ever exist.
Yeah, be
little
careful.
Guilty secrets that lurk in the stars.
Yeah, about meeting your characters, though.
And Scott, you talked handsome and loyal and wonderful, and that is you wrapped right up. So you are very much that.
Oh.
And, but then when people say, like you just said, that we write who we are. And then I look at my characters and think, oh, but they're rude and sarcastic and sometimes offensive. And you know, and then I think, yeah, that's probably me.
Well, as long as they wear great boots.
Wear great boots. That's right. That's right. Oh, goodness. So tell us, Scott, what I know this answer, of course, but I'm going to ask it for the bookers who are listening. Do you write full time or do you have a day job?
I do have a day job. I work for the city government in the city where I live in their IT department. I've been writing for about 10 years, but really only the last few years have I started to think about it as a business. So, you know, I do have a goal of one day making a significant portion, if not my entire income, from my writing. But at this point, I've got to split my time between my day job and my writing.
Right. So I feel your pain.
We're all the same.
Resonates strongly. So look, so Scott, so when you're writing, what does a typical day kind of look like for you? Is it, you know, are you just sort of scribbling away in the corners, or do you try and make time to write separate from everything else?
Do you write at work?
If my boss is listening, no.
Took the words right out of my mouth, my friend.
I write, quote, at lunchtime, unquote.
Ah, oh, got it. Yeah.
So, you know, I write, and I have a family, and I have kids, and you've got to make time. You can't find time. Because if you say, oh yeah, I'll find time. No, you never will. You make it a priority. And I personally prefer to write in sprints. And I am blessed to be a pretty fast typist when it comes to composing. And by the way, I type. I cannot handwrite worth a damn. Yeah, so stuff is typed. And so, yeah, I'll write in like 15, 20 minute sprints. And I can get a good, 1,000, 1,500 words done in 20 minutes.
You and I are very similar like that, because I found, and I've talked about this on different guest interviews that I've had where I've been the guest, that that's how I write, being the fact that I have, you know, a lot of spawn and a day job and a busy life, as we do, that finding 20 minutes is easy to me. I can find 20 minutes. I can, and in that 20 minutes, you make that 20 minutes the biggest 20 minutes that you can do, and you tune out and you throw down as many words as you can. And if you do that 3 or 4 times, or even twice in the day, you know, if you can get 1,000 or 1,500 words in that 20 minutes, which is highly possible, bookers, you can do it. Honestly, I do it. Scott does it. You know, you can be turning out a 3,000 word day at the minimum. It's highly possible and really effective way of writing for the busy lifestyle.
Yes. And I mean, you know, I've got friends that, oh, I've got to have this music playing and I've got to have candles and I've got to have this and that and the other thing. I'm like, no, I go. Like, I don't care what's going on around me. When I need to write, all I need is a pathway to Google Docs and I'm good.
I have to have the music though, because that's got to drown out the world. It's spawn aloud. Spawn aloud, people. God,
it gets
ball gags, or I need music. One or the other.
It gets better.
And theoretically, ball gagging your kids is not looked upon kindly, so I have to use the music.
I looked, and technically, there's no rule against that. Probably.
Well, yeah, I've not seen that written down anywhere. Thou shalt not ball gag the kids. So, hey, it's a look.
So good.
People might not understand immediately when they see, but hey,
yeah, I could justify it.
So, Scott, that sounds like, I mean, you say your other people need music and all that kind of stuff. Do you have any sort of rituals around starting a new project or when you write, or is it literally just, I'm in the zone, I'm sitting, and I'm just writing away? How does that work?
Well, it depends on what I'm writing. So I've mentioned that I like writing short stories, and if I'm writing a short story, I'm a complete pantser. I might have an idea as to the beginning, middle, and end, but it's in my head, and it's very flexible. With my novels, especially the Jenny Dare series and the Esho St. Clair series, because they're mysteries for the most part, even though their primary genres are not mysteries, but because they're sort of the plot usually involves a mystery, I have to have a much more detailed, I wouldn't call it an outline, but a much more detailed idea, a written down idea of things like major beats and pairings and major characters. When I wrote my first novel, rephrase that. When I wrote my first good novel, I used what's called the snowflake method, which is a method I recommend highly to anybody who doesn't think they can outline. If you've already got an outline process, great. If you don't, Google the snowflake method. It's very granular, and really all I follow are the first 6 or 7 steps. There's like, I don't know, 12 or 15 steps. But basically, if you follow the first few steps, one, you've already got your blurb written for you, because the first step is writing one sentence that encapsulates the entire story idea, beginning, middle, and end. The second step is writing a paragraph that expands on that first sentence. And then it also says, you know, write some character information in this format, and it's some other thing. Basically, you're gradually building a snowball, much like it sounds, into something where eventually you're starting to write the novel. And when you start writing the novel, you've already got everything in place. So my very first good novel that I published, Jenny Dare, Crimson Sands, was written using a variation on the snowflake model, and I really liked it. So yeah, basically, if I'm writing a short story, complete pantsing, spur of the moment, you know, stuff. If I'm writing a novel, I will do some amount of outlining.
Yeah.
No, I know Zinta will express outrage at the whole concept, but
damn it.
I absolutely hear you there. And I don't formally snowflake it, but I might try that.
It's really good.
I need to know where the waymarks are in the story, particularly because I try to build. There needs to be an element of not quite knowing where things are heading and where things are going, and to get that into the writing, I need to know where it's going to end up, so I can lay false trails and drop clues and hints throughout. So you're speaking my language there. I hear you.
No, totally pants it. No pants in that case. Just throw your pants to the side, throw your formats to the side, throw it and just zen into the zone and write the damn story, people. Come on.
Well, I will say I agree with Sintra in one aspect. A lot of writers, especially new writers, will fall into this trap where they have to get their outline and their story Bible and everything and just perfectly in place. And that stops them from doing the actual writing.
See, I look at people, it this way. Go on, sorry, Scott.
I was going to say, to people like you, Zen, who are sort of anti, you know, plotting, there's still a lot of discovery writing that is to be done, even. Because, like I said, I don't write this super granular, you know, freaking ridiculous outline. I still allow myself the freedom to discover and go off the beaten path occasionally, as long as I've got something I can return to periodically and check in.
Yeah, look, if for me personally, writing, all right, especially with the upcoming, with the wave of indie authors that are here, you know. Everybody's writing a book, which is fantastic. I love it. Please write your books, people. It is wonderful. I love reading all these different stories that everybody has. Now, the problem is that new authors sometimes get stuck into having to write the book, the next bestseller. What format Yes. can I write? What format can I do to make the next best-selling book? Well, there is Yes. no real format for that. It's luck of the fucking draw, people. So I don't ever write to market, and I know people do, and bookers don't get all up in my grill. It's okay. You can write to market. Me personally will not. I want my books to be organic. I want my books to be authentically Sintra. I want people to read them and go, that is Sintra's voice, like you would Yes. Stephen King. You read a Stephen King book and you go, that is authentically Stephen King. You cannot replicate him. He cannot be anybody else but him. And you can identify his books because of his authenticity. So that's why I like to not plot or predict my books in any way. I just want it to, I feel a little hippie right now. I just want it to just evolve and I don't know, ripple out of me like some beautiful penny drop in an ocean. I don't know.
But surely the important part is, like Stephen King, they know it's a Zintra book because it exists and they can buy it. It is finished.
That is true.
They know it's a Scott Roche because
my name is right there on the cover. Even
I know, but I'm sorry, I can pick up some books and it could be written by 50 different authors that I know because it is so fucking cookie cutter romance or cookie cutter thriller or cookie cutter murder that it could be written by a dozen different authors that I know.
Now, I agree. I see what you're saying, and I agree with you 1,000%. I know that's not mathematically possible. I agree with you 1,000%. because you know, the idea for me and for you, it sounds like writing to market is antithetical, and you know, following a formula is antithetical. I don't follow a formula, and I don't propose that anybody should. I do find, though, that using some structure prior to the writing process and during the writing process, for me personally, cuts way back on the editing process.
Awesome.
So, you know, that's part of the reason I advocate it. And everybody's got their own way of doing
things. Absolutely. And I am not down on anybody's techniques. We all have to find our niche. We have to find our groove. We have to find the way that works best for us as individuals. So more power to
Absolutely.
Everybody's different groove. Now, something that I wanted to ask before I get on to audiobooks, which is something that both David and I are intrigued about. Now, characters. When a character comes to you, do they come fully formed, or do you make them? Do you create them? I guess this plays with your pantser or not pantser writing.
Right. And actually, again, that, I have the same answer for that as I did for the previous question, which is it depends. If I'm writing something short, then I'll do a lot more discovery on the character. Whereas if I'm writing something longer, because there has to be consistency, there has to be, you know, a more of a background established, especially if you're doing a series. And because I don't write my series like back to back to back, I like having all this stuff in writing. I will tend to develop the character. Like, I don't know what their favorite wine is. I don't know what high school they went to. I might know their birthday. But, you know, I know the pertinent details to the story and enough about their background that, you know, I feel like I'm firmly...
You can be consistent.
Right, and I'm firmly concrete. This is who that character is. Like, I can tell you things about Esho St. Clair that have never showed up in any of the books so far. I can tell you things about Jenny Dare that have never showed up in the books so far. But usually they're not, you know, like, what tea does she drink? Or, you know, who was her celebrity crush? You know, these kinds of things I see on Twitter. But again, I'm not dogging. If people know this about their characters, great. But,
You know, I only know what they tell me. If they don't tell me, I don't know it. So I can't answer some questions. I could look at Carr, my Reaper man, my Boner man. I could look at Carr and go, hey, what's your celebrity crush? He would just look at me and tell me to fuck off. I have more important things to do right now than that. You know? He just wouldn't answer the question, so I can't answer those. If they don't tell me, I don't know, people. I don't know.
Now, the fun thing...
See, I think I'm more with Scott for the big characters. There are things that have... And it's kind of a funny process. There are things that have come to light and I've thought about, not while I'm writing, but when I'm thinking about the characters, that I sort of... So a little like you said, yeah, they tell me things. I'll discover their stuff they like or stuff that happened in their past, and sometimes it'll make it into the story, and sometimes it'll just be there sat in the back in a little note, scribbled note somewhere, and later in the story or in a different one the fact will come to light and it'll become useful. So I actually find it's worth for the big characters, it is worth just having a scratch pad somewhere where you can put these ideas down.
What's super fun
for consistency,
what's super fun for me, and David, you kind of mentioned this earlier, are those sort of secondary or background characters. And where I get my creative, you know, fix is when one of those characters wakes up and starts talking to me in the way that you're talking about.
Yes.
You know, like I have a character who is his name is Morpheus, and he's a background character in the Esho St. Clair books. And he was just a throwaway character in one of the shorter first stories, but he plays a major part in the novel because he kind of woke up and said, I'm here. This is the person that Esho needs to talk to. And I found out he was gay. I didn't know he was gay, but it turns out he's gay. So, and that's not anything that I like established beforehand. It's just something that, you know, he said, this is who I am. So, yeah, I love that. And I love like, novels and TV shows and movies that have these secondary characters that'll occasionally pop up, and I want to read that character's novel. I want to read that character's, you know, I want to see that character's movie.
That's funny because I at the moment I'm writing the fourth book in my Dragon series, my Apalala Clan series, about five dragon brothers. Now, in book one, a secondary character called Kylie, and she was a throwaway character. She was supposed to be the best friend of the female lead. Well, she is the best friend of the female lead. She drives 50s groovy cars. She swears like a sailor. She's loyal to a T. She will kill for her friends, kind of person. Probably me, really. And she, when she first came to me, she was a secondary character, throwaway, just there for a bit of comic relief, sarcasm, etc. And now she is fighting with me for her own book because she has become such a dominant character in the series and was never meant to be, but she will not let go. She is a pain in my ass right now because she wants her own book. And I'm like, sweetheart, I can't write your book. There's only supposed to be five books because there's five brothers. And she's gone, I'm going to grow a penis. There's going to be six brothers. We're a girlfriend. I'm getting the book. And I'm like, holy shit. You know, so you cannot control them. So, I cannot control them sometimes. So I dare doubt that the Apalala Clan series is going to end up being a six damn book series. Ah, the things I have to do.
So, sorry. Ah, lordy. Scott, we're both really interested to know about this. So let's get into it. Now, you've started getting audiobooks done of your stories. How do you do that?
Okay, so that there's a story behind that. So the whole reason I started writing in the first place on the regular basis is way back in the 2009, early 2010, somewhere in there, I got an iPod and I started listening to podcasts and I discovered podcast fiction and I started listening to podcast fiction and I was like, shit, I can write better than this. I started writing and I started making friends with people in the podcast community and in the podcast fiction community. And so fast forward to a few years ago, I started looking at, you know, I've got these books, audiobooks are a big thing. Podcast fiction is still a pretty big thing. I got to make audiobooks or podcast versions of my books, but to give people who want that the option. I've got a good voice. I'm a fairly decent narrator, but one of the things I've learned as an independent creator is to know what your limitations are. And I would rather spend time writing than I would narrating my stuff and investing in all the gear that you need to do that. So I had really a very good friend who was in the narrator space. Her name's Veronica Jaguer. She's an amazing narrator and audio producer.
I've heard her.
I have no doubt.
I've heard her on, she's voiced on the Drabblecast a few times. Yeah, she's got great.
So she has voiced my first Jenny Dare novel, and she'll eventually voice my second Jenny Dare novel. So I was talking to her, and I was like, I know these are, I've done shorter stuff. I've had people do shorter stuff, but this is my first novel. What do you recommend? I want you to do it. I was like, you are the voice of this book. And she introduced me to SpokenRealms.com. And I would urge anybody who's thinking about doing an audiobook to go to SpokenRealms.com first, because they have a stable of voice actors and a stable of writers. And they have a business model that means, like, okay, you've got basically, if you go through ACX, which is Audible, which is Kindle's thing, you've got two options. You can either do profit sharing or you can do pay the narrator up front, whatever their fee is, and then you get all the stuff. Well, the nice thing about Spoken Realms is they do profit sharing. Basically, they take a cut and they give the author and the voice actor a cut, and their cut is very modest. And they, whereas if you do profit sharing with Audible, you can only release through Audible. With Spoken Realms, if you do profit sharing, you can release through Audible, Apple.com, like 8 or 10 other platforms. And they do basically they just cut you, like Audible, they just cut you a check at the end of every period. Very reliable, very trustworthy. So I would recommend people go there as an option. And also, so that's what I did with the Jenny Deere book. And so the other thing that I did for the Esher St. Clair books is I, again, one of my friends in the podcasting community, super talented, named Dave Robeson. I heard his voice and I was like, you're the voice of Esher St. Clair. I want you to narrate my stuff. And he and I worked out, some profit sharing through ACX because he's not in the Spoken Realms, stable, although eventually he probably will be. So those basically, I tell people if you're a writer who wants to do an audiobook, if you can do your own audiobook, that's the quote best way because then you don't have to share the profits with anybody. And
But then you're limited to one voice and your
that
own
right.
talents. And like you say, sometimes you kind of have to decide where your
Oh,
talent
and I
spots
don't have
lie.
a voice for it. I don't have a voice for narration. Ugh,
And
I'd have
that's
to get someone.
important. That's important to know. Like you can do, you can only do what you can do. And with voice actors who are dedicated to their craft, like Veronica and like Dave, they can do more than just read. They're performing. They're not just reading your book. They're performing your book and coming up with voices from different characters. And even if it's not a separate voice, they at least develop a pattern of speaking for particular characters. So, and how the ACX thing works, which is absolutely great if that's the option you need to go with, you put on an audition. You basically go to ACX, upload your manuscript, say I've got rights to it. You basically put out an ad essentially in the ACX community, and you say I'm looking for this kind of voice, a female in her 30s to 40s, blah blah blah. People and you put up a chunk of your manuscript for them to audition essentially, and then you go through the auditions and you pick the one you like, and you're off to the races. Personally, I like having a relationship with the voice actor because I know they're not going to flake on me. I know what they're capable of. I know what their work ethic is. So I like to deal with friends or at least not strangers. But again, a lot of people have had a lot of success with the ACX model and going through their pool. So that is the nice thing about all of these solutions is you, as the creator, as the writer, you just leave it to somebody else to do, and it gets done, and you get paid, and
And you can carry on with writing and focusing on
exactly,
that.
exactly. The only thing that you have to do is
But
quality assurance, basically making sure that as it's recorded, you like what the person's doing.
right, so almost you're the executive
Right,
producer
exactly.
on the thing. And are you not tempted to do a Stan Lee and have a little cameo in your audiobooks?
I mean, if it were a multi-voice, like if it were multiple narrators, multiple voice actors, yes, absolutely, I would. But with one person doing all the legwork, I don't want to detract from their ability and their dedication. And I'm already there in the character, so I and in fact, depending on the story, I may actually be in there. Like I have that M. Night Shyamalan thing where I will occasionally insert myself, and basically I just file the serial numbers off. but that's clearly me. Like, if anybody knew me, that bit character is clearly me.
See, it's funny. But audiobooks is something that I've always looked at. I mean, okay, audio, it's, to me, it's tricky, audiobooks, because if somebody, if I've read the book and then I go and listen to the story, if it's not the voice that I thought it was, it doesn't work for me. I don't know. Maybe I'm broken. It could be that I'm broken. It's like watching a movie to writing a reading the book, and I know I can hear Caleb in my head going, they're very different entities, Sintra. They're different. You have to just listen to them differently.
But the voice does make a difference.
If it's not the right voice, like if you read a book and you hear a male voice dominant in it, and then they chose a female to read it, it wouldn't sit right with me. I don't. I fear, because I'd love to do an audiobook. I'd love to put my dragons or Car. Car would make a great audiobook. I would love to do that. But I fear that would I choose the wrong voice for the people who are listening? I don't know.
Well, you've got to just throw that to the curb, because you can't predict any more than you could in terms of the writing itself and your creative voice. You can't predict what's going to gel with the consumer any more than you can figure out what's going to gel with the consumer with an audiobook. All you can do is trust your instincts. And because you're in charge, ultimately, with all of these models that I've mentioned, of the voice, ultimately, of who narrates your work. And because you're an independent creator, because you're in control, you're not leaving it up to your publisher to choose for you. That's the thing I love about, I'm a bit of a control freak. You know, you're in charge of making sure that, as far as you're concerned, this is the best person for the job. And that's the best you can do.
And I guess there would be more, okay, so like you read a book and it then gets made into a movie, you're more likely to do both, where I guess people who read books as opposed to people who listen to books, they probably don't do both in the same book.
Yeah, it's very rare. There have been a few cases where I have both read the book and listened to the book for various reasons. But it's a very rare case, I think, where people are going to do both. You're either an audiobook person or you are a text person, whether it's print or ebook. I know people that hate audiobooks, and I'm like, why do you hate audiobooks? Do you not watch movies? Do you not read, you know, do you not watch television? Do you not listen to, you know, the radio? I mean, I just don't understand. But it's okay that I don't understand it. I just don't. And I actually, for me, it's a little bit of a time-saving thing. Like, I can listen to an audiobook more easily in a lot of cases, especially when I've had a long commute. Than I can reading.
Yes.
So I like them both equally. Like you said, Sin, it does depend on, you know, if I've listened to an audiobook and in the first few minutes I don't like the person's voice, then I'm probably not going to finish the audiobook, but I'll probably read the text, you know, for instance.
Yeah.
It does make a difference. I mean, I'm sure that the same in the States, but here in Australia, you can't get in the car and drive for less than like 15 hours straight just to go to town. It's a big old place. So listening to a story while driving is brilliant. But the voice is important. It does make a difference. I'm a huge fan, I'm sure I've said a few times on the podcast, of Neil Gaiman. He's my Stephen King. His stuff's wonderful. And they've audiobooked most of what he's written, but also Terry Pratchett.
Yes.
And all of Pratchett's books have been done. And Baldrick does most of the voice work on those books. So if it's a series and it's the same voice, even if initially it didn't quite work, I got a series of audiobooks from the David Eddings, the Belgariad and the Malorian series. And the guy who did the voice has a very distinctive voice, and it didn't sound right because I'd read the books as a teenager and loved them. Just listening to the first one, I thought, it doesn't quite. And then suddenly it clicked, got used to it, and it was my old favorite stories again, and I will read the books and listen to the audio because I'm strange. But I think you're right. Most people.
I've got to pitch my most favorite and least favorite audiobook performances, not counting people that I know. My favorite, and this one might surprise you. Do either of you know who Bronson Pinchot is? The actor.
No.
Okay, so there was a series in America in the 80s, I think, called Perfect Strangers, and it was about these two guys who were brothers. Like, I don't know, they're like.
Yeah, I know the show.
Okay, so Bronson Pinchot played Balky Bartokomous.
Oh, really?
Okay, so I grew up knowing him as that character and did not realize, first of all, that he doesn't have that accent because he's an actor. He did an audiobook version of Stephen King's Eyes of the Dragon. And it is absolutely phenomenal. Crazy, crazy good. Mm-hmm. He basically found a second career in narrating audiobooks, and he is amazing. My least favorite is Ice-T.
Oh.
That's a name you probably know. The rapper, Ice-T. Yep. Narrated a story from the legend of Driss Jordan. Ice-T narrated a D&D book. He does not. He was like, I don't know what D&D is. What is Dungeons and Dragons? What are role-playing? Go to Audible and search for books narrated by Ice-T and listen to the sample of Comrades at Odds. It is him. And it's Ice-T. Like, he's not. He's not even trying.
Oh, that is special.
He's not even trying to understand what's going on. And it's hilarious. But it's hilarious in a bad way. You know, it's so bad that it's good. Those are two really good examples of voice that works, voice that does not work. And so you have to be careful. You do have to be careful. Mm.
I listen quite a lot to the Drabblecast, and Norm Sherman, who tends to, he does most of the narration.
Love Norm.
And then occasionally they'll do a full cast, and Veronica Giguere has done stuff on that before. His actual speaking voice and his narrating character voice are totally different. Having listened to the cast for a long time and just heard the narrating voice, he did a couple of episodes where he just dropped back into his normal voice. It wasn't Norm. It was like, hang on, that's weird. Yeah, so audiobooks are cool. Hey, I just coming back on a slight tangent at the moment because I'm kind of intrigued. I hadn't actually seen this term, but it made perfect sense when I heard it. What to you? So you're credited with writing Gaslight Fantasy. What do you say that is? How do you define Gaslight Fantasy?
So you know that I it's funny. I wrote these Esher St. First I wrote the Esher St. Clair, like these novellas that I put out as a there are two novellas in one ebook, and I couldn't call them steampunk. Right. Because it has some of the elements of steampunk, but not really. It's not urban fantasy, because when you hear that, you think modern day, typically Harry Dresden kind of, you know, modern day setting. And it wasn't until I put out the novel and started talking to some people about it that somebody said the term gaslight or gas lamp. You'll hear them interchangeably. Fantasy. And that's basically Victorian setting, urban fantasy. So, and I thought that was so perfect because it differentiated from urban fantasy. It differentiated from steampunk. And it makes perfect sense because you've got the gas lamp lighting and it's very atmospheric. And then you've got the fantasy elements. So it's the perfect explanation of, in a nutshell, of what these stories are. And I found out afterwards, you know, this is a subgenre that's increasingly popular. So, you know, cause you've got a lot of stuff like there's a Netflix series that came out last year that the name of which is escaping me. that was one of the main characters was a fairy, and it's sort of like Peaky Blinders with fantasy elements.
Yes,
you know.
So if your work was being ranked alongside Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, the Philip Pullman's The Book of Dust, and the Northern Lights, you'd be
I would with that very much so. I would be over the moon, especially with Jonathan Strange all, and Mr. Norrell, which you want to talk about a beast of a book, but if you stick with it, it pays off.
It does indeed. It's huge, but it's
and the really League of and it took me a while to figure out what the author was doing, because I was like, why is this so dense? And I was like, oh yeah, I'm an English major. This is how they wrote in the late 1800s. So it's, you know, it's my book is very much that, but not as dense as the prose is not as dense. But I think I did a pretty good job of capturing the speech and the vocabulary. And I owe it to a lot of reading of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, and, you know, just consuming a lot of popular culture that takes place in that time period. But I love the addition of magic, because it throws sort of the monkey wrench. It gives something that's distinctly different from the police procedurals that you would find ordinarily in this setting. There's a Canadian series that's really good, about a police detective. The name of it's escaping me, but it takes place in Canada in the late 1800s. And the thing I loved about it, and the thing I loved about a lot of the other bits of pop culture that take place in the late 19th, early 20th centuries, is you've got so many big personalities that were alive during this time. You know, Teddy Roosevelt in America, you know, at Nikola Tesla, which features Nikola he's actually the client in one of the Esho St. Clair stories, and then he becomes a sort of sidekick in the novel, and because he's just a fascinating person.
So do you end up doing a lot of research around all of that sort of stuff before you start writing, or do you just drop pieces in?
Well, one of the things that I would have told you 5 years ago, maybe, is that one of the reasons why I wrote science fiction and fantasy is I hated research and I could just make shit up.
That resonates with me.
But I was like, well, if I'm going to write a story that takes place in an identifiable place and time, I have to make sure that I'm going to screw it up. And it turns out I had a lot of wrong preconceived notions about what life was like in Manhattan in the late 1800s, not the least of which is it wasn't called New York City in the 1880s. It wasn't called New York City until the 1900s. So my...
Was it still
no, it was just, they were just called the individual boroughs. So it was Manhattan and oh, Queens. Right. And so it wasn't really New York City until, you know, all the five boroughs together until the 1900s. So, and I thought I knew a lot about what parts of Manhattan would be like, and I was completely wrong. And I found out about the intense poverty that was going on, and I was able to put that into the story. Yeah, I knew there was poverty, but it was bad. Corruption, which gave me a great hook for the novel, you know, because shortly after the novel, events of the novel in the real world, they actually did a huge overhaul of the law enforcement system in New York, because it was absolutely, you know, you think it's corrupt now. It was 100 times worse. 100.
Yeah, but back then it would have been completely controlled.
And like, for example, and this is a thing that I don't know how it was in Australia 100 years ago, but I went to, on my honeymoon, I went to Charleston, South Carolina, and we saw these historic buildings from like the 1800s, and they had badges on them that were fire department badges. And basically in that time period in the United States, if your building started to burn, if you did not have a badge on your building, they would not put out the fire. They would sell you a badge, and then they would put out the fire.
Oh.
It was very similar in London in that kind of era.
So
definitely.
Yeah, and that's the kind of thing that you learn if you do research. So I tell people, you know, if you don't like doing research, don't write historical fiction. If you do historical fiction, you really need to do your homework. And I read a lot of incredible books. So
we've discussed this a few times on the podcast that if you're going to write, you write what you know, and if you don't know it, then you've got to research it before you write it.
Yes.
Otherwise, you just end up stuffing it up, and nobody wants to stuff up their books.
No, I mean, so you're going to get something wrong. You're going to get several things wrong. No doubt I have gotten things wrong in my books, but at least you can say, I did my homework. I messed that part up, but at least I gave it a try. You know, I made the attempt.
Because if you get something wrong in your book, trust me, somebody's going to see it and somebody's going to tell you about it. From my experience, people will tell you if you are wrong. And you're like, okay, thanks for that. Appreciate it.
And it's funny, and so I didn't realize this until I had been writing for a while. I will typically not tell the reader the name of the city that they're in.
Yeah,
the reason I do that is because it makes it a little more universal. But I mean, the Esher St. Clair book, it had to be in Manhattan, so I had to know what that was like.
I like to vague write because I allow the reader more room for their own interpretation to come into it. Also, I hate timelines. sorry.
Well, I'm struggling with something similar. I've got a mythos-inspired sort of real-world story that's sort of percolating away at the moment. And I'm trying not to make it of a specific time. So there are things like, does the protagonist fish his mobile out to look to Google stuff? Or is that going to just lead me down and tie me down into a particular time or place? And I want it to be quite timeless, so it could kind of, it's set out on the British East Coast. And East Anglia is a strange, there's more of it than fits on the map. It's one of those kinds of parts of the world. It's the A to Z gets all hazy around the edges, and it just says, there'll be beasties here. So it's a great place to set a sort of a pseudo horror fantasy. But I'm desperately trying not to make it of any particular time. And so, bizarrely, yes, I'm ending up researching. I like the vagueness in the story sometimes.
I mean, sometimes it has to be really pinpointed. Some stories really account for that, and that's great. I just try. Maybe I'm just a lazy writer. I don't know.
Well, I mean, like, I'm writing something right now that I'm posting to my Patreon, and it's called The Hunters, and I'm influenced a lot in this story by Stranger Things. And what I want to avoid, one of the things I loved about Stranger Things was I'm a child of the 80s and I loved all the 80s stuff. But at the same time, if you weren't a child of the 80s, you might not appreciate it as much. So I'm trying to basically do something like Stranger Things without all of the nostalgia packed in. But it, like you said, it kind of leads me to ask the question, when does this take place? Are these kids going to have cell phones? If they're not going to have cell phones, then obviously it isn't. It doesn't take place in the 2000s. If they don't have cell phones, if they do have cell phones, why do they not work? Because it's a horror story, so the cell phone has to not work in order for the story to work.
But you can still keep it vague within, you know, a couple of decades worth of time essence. You don't have to pin it down to a certain year. I mean, the 80s, God bless them, we love them. Best music, best fashion, best hairdos, come on. I was only telling my girls about
we're all there. We're all on the same page.
So, I have them you can amazing pin it down to decades. Sorry?
I had the most amazing mullet in the 90s.
Oh, nice. knows? Gotta love a good mullet. They're coming back up here in Australia. There's a lot of kids with mullets running around. It's scary.
God bless them.
All right.
Particularly with Corona.
Yeah, with
yes.
Corona, the ISO hairdo. Now, we're going to have to be bringing this to a close. I could talk to you for hours, Scott. This is fascinating stuff. Although we do talk daily, so we'll just carry it on later.
There you go.
Tell me, or tell the bookers, what's your latest and where can we find you?
Well, the latest, we've been talking about it a little bit here, obviously, is Esho St. Clair and the Damsels of Desire. You can get that on ebook as a print book. And if you want, if you're one of those people who loves audiobooks, I am putting it out every week. I'm putting a chapter of audio out on my Patreon, which is patreon.com/ScottRoche. That's ScottRoche. And I'm also, that's where I'm also putting out my short, I'll call it a short story because at this point I'm not sure, The Hunters. You can find me on Twitter at Spiritual Tramp, which eventually I need to change to my author name because I got it when Twitter was new.
I did question that. I went, okay.
But if you search for Scott Roche on Twitter, you'll find me. If you just go to my website, scottroche.com, you'll find links to everything there. I got to say, one little piece of advice to writers. You're probably going to run into a period of time in your writing career, if you do it long enough, where you're going to dry up. You're going to have a dead zone. And my advice is not to give up. I took about a year or a year and a half where I did not write any fiction that anyone knows about. And that's okay. It was very carefully worded. Thank you.
Nicely done.
And that's okay. You know, sometimes you have to reinvent yourself. Sometimes you have to strike out in new directions. But I wanted to write something that was very identifiably Scott Roche again. And that's what I'm doing with this sort of young adult horror story, The Hunters. So, you know, if you like good horror, if you like Gaslamp Fantasy, if you like good science fiction, scottroche.com is where you can find all that.
That's fantastic advice, Scott. I really like that and very prevalent to me right now. And touched my soul. It touched my soul.
Aww.
it's a fear that I have right at this very present point in time and something that I'll be discussing on the podcast this week too. So I appreciate that piece of advice. I'll take that on a personal level. And I hope the bookers take something from that as well.
Me too.
Thank you so much for joining us on What the Book. I have thoroughly enjoyed every second of speaking with you. I always do. You're a very fascinating man.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate you guys having me on. It's been a while since I've appeared on a podcast as a guest, and I've missed it. So this has been lovely.
Both enlightening and entertaining.
Oh, I have,
it's been great to meet you.
Can I plug one other thing real quick that's not mine?
Absolutely. Plug it.
Because your audience is probably to a large degree writers and listen to podcasts, if you've never listened to Dead Robots Society, that is probably, in my opinion, the best writing podcast other than this one.
I was so happy you just added that on there. Otherwise, I totally would have been deleting it. Delete.
I'm not just saying that because I was a guest host on Dead Robot Society for a while, but basically the two hosts have been friends of mine my whole writing career, and they're both making it work, and they've got great advice. And there's literally, I think they're in their eighth or ninth year of of podcasting, and it's been one of the two guys has been there the whole time. The other guy's been there the last 5 or 6 years, I guess, and I was on there for about 2 years. You can avoid my, you know, chunk if you
I'm going to go hunt you down now.
But a lot of great stuff and a lot of great advice. But you guys are also doing great work. And As long as people are just writing, just write, you know.
Just write. Exactly.
That's what makes you a writer. You write.
Exactly. And I mean, this podcast, it's only like our second season now. And we're getting there. We primarily it's indie authors supporting indie authors. That's what we're about. So anything that we can do to help the indie community, the writing community, we're all for it. And introducing new people around and getting their voices out there. It's what we love to do. Mm-hmm. But we will definitely check out that podcast. It sounds like one that I should have on my favorites list. Absolutely.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Scott, for joining us on What the Book. It has been an utter pleasure.
Thank you. It's been awesome.
And thank you, David, of course, always. You are one of my two favorite co-hosts ever.
This has been a great start to a Saturday
morning.
To
meet you.
It's been great to meet you, Scott.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming on the show.
All right, bookers. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next week. Bye.